Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Nama Harumai, welcome into the Caucus Podcast. This Thursday, it's just after 11:30 a.m, Thursday, September the 3rd. Things may well have changed by the time you listen to this podcast. But, it is seven Saturdays to Election Day. Parliament's risen for a second time. Parties are kicking off their campaigns again after the false start. President correct for today's caucus.
Lisa Owen.
Guyon Espiner.
Scott Campbell.
And Tim Watkin. Nice to have you in with us today. On today's agenda, the Greens school, resignation calls, parties' election chances, all that stuff. The impact of social media on the campaign, more COVID confusion, and just exactly who is in the government these days anyway. We'll talk about that over the next bit. Let's start with the Greens.
Yeah, so we've got James Shaw in the hot seat, really, and it's getting hotter and hotter as the days go by. So this is in relation to funding for a green school in Taranaki, $11.7 million, which James Shaw was pushing for big time, it now appears, and the funding was approved. But the problem is the Green Party has a policy. It doesn't support funding for private schools.
So James Shaw calls a press conference after stalling or consulting for a few days and says this.
The decision that I made to support this project was an error of judgment for which I apologise. If I was making the same decision again, I would not support the project. Becoming a minister means being willing to question your decisions in public and, if necessary, to correct them. And that's what I'm doing. So again, I apologise. I apologise to parents, to teachers and to unions. I apologise to Green Party members who have been working tirelessly in their communities to make sure that the Greens are a part of the next government and have felt demoralised by this decision. I apologise to the schools in Taranaki who, quite rightfully, want the best for their children.
I might have been the only one who didn't get an apology.
Take it personally.
It might have been
He's
quicker to,
really sorry.
To name the people who he wasn't going to apologise to. I do feel a bit sorry for James Shaw on this. I think there's an element too of the sort of the prefect who was caught doing drugs or something. You know, it's because the Greens take such the moral high ground a lot, people really enjoy putting the boot in when they fall short of that. And fair enough, I get all those concerns, but I do think that they are paying the price a little bit for their previous occupation of the moral high ground.
Is always the problem, right? They're supposed to be the good guys, and so when they fall short of that, it plays into a stereotype for them.
It's a little bit unfair because others who don't play by the rules a lot will push their barrows a bit too hard.
Who are you thinking of, guys?
In this case, you know, in terms of COVID spending, we saw $72.5 million announced by the Minister for Racing, Winston Peters, to bail out the horse racing industry. $72.5 million.
Versus 11.7.
And people expect them to support the horse racing industry because he's had a long, close relationship and interest in that for a long time. So I suppose they didn't really blink an eyelid too much. And this, there was hypocrisy from the Greens. But I think it's been a bit overblown in my view.
But let's speak more bluntly about this. Are you saying, because this is a party that doesn't normally publicly hold people to ransom to get its way, that, now that we've seen they've done it once and they've fallen a bit flat on their face, others do it all the time, so maybe we shouldn't worry so much about it?
No, I'm not saying we shouldn't worry so much about it, but I think that they have the momentum behind it has been, in my view, it's been a bit overblown. I'm not saying it's not an issue. It's a significant one. I think sort of leading the news for a week on it has been overblown, in my view.
Scotty,
you've got to wonder.
Yeah.
You've got to wonder, though, it is a little bit of, and I think Winston Peters said this over the last couple of days, that naivety of a new minister, or at least somebody who has not sat around that table previously. You know, looking at an application, and just because it had the word green in it and giving it a sign-off, you know, he would have been fighting the Labor side of that table in New Zealand First for possibly crumbs. And while 11.7 is not crumbs, in the scheme of the however big that CIP process was, he got a little part. He went with a project that looked green, that sounded green, that I guess is green, but it's just, for me, it demonstrates a little bit of that split between the sort of business-orientated side of the Green Party, who are there to try and fight for the green side of things and that social justice side, and a bit of a disconnect between those two. And I think, you know, six apologies or something. He said sorry six times or something like that in his mea culpa. Good on him for owning it, I guess, at this stage. But it shows a huge split in that party.
Yeah, it does. But if we can put the Green Party machinations to one side for a second.
Yeah, we'll get to those in a second.
Yeah, the thing that I really find interesting about this is, doesn't it show us that projects are not chosen on their merit? And shouldn't we be concerned about
not
that?
Not in a crisis like this, right? This is, I mean, you said, Scott, it was $3 billion, you know, and applicants had, what, 10 days to get in a bid for their shovel-ready projects. All the projects had to be at least $10 million. So this was, you know, just above. It was at the low end. And I think you're right. He probably looked at that and said, oh, it's got green in the title, tick. It's in the regions, tick. It's education, tick. It's a box-ticking exercise. Yeah. And you've got 2,000 applicants in the end, whittled down to, I think, 150 they actually funded. Mm. You've got to wonder about those other 149, right? Because this was a rushed process.
Yeah, but it's not even when it's not a rushed process. Come on, everyone's batting for their own team and for projects that are in areas where they need votes.
Absolutely. Look at the Provincial Growth Fund. It's been handled in a similar way. And yet, are we following good process with these things? And should politicians be in the position where they're ticking off the things that will make their constituents, whether it's the Green Party or New Zealand First, that will please their constituents? Or should it actually be neutral public service?
Some kind of commission. I keep thinking in that context about, you know, you had Christiana Figueres from the UN Climate Change People on the After the Virus podcast that you made. And it just really stuck with me what she said, that we thought we had a decade to try and work on climate change, but that worldwide something like $10 to $20 trillion is going to spend in the next year or two on all of these economic recovery, all these stimulus packages around the world. And she said, so that's now, that 10 years we had to fix climate change is down to 18 months, because all the spending that was going to be spent over the next is locked in now. It's going to get decided in the next 18 months. So if we're going to get green change, then that's got to happen in these decisions now. So I can see why someone like James Shaw is trying to tick boxes and try and get green spending wherever he can tick a box, right?
Well, do your homework then, if that's the kind of spending
absolutely,
that you want.
Yeah.
But also, there was Treasury advice. Let's not overlook the fact that there was...
But ministers often ignore Treasury advice.
Well, what's the point of getting it then? Which brings us back to Guyon's point about, if we're spending big coin here, that does there need to be some kind of commission? And this is, we've discussed this heaps before, intergenerational decisions, which is kind of what you're talking about with climate change. Taking the politics out of certain decisions that generations are going to be stuck with for years to come. And I'm not suggesting that a green school in Taranaki having a few extra classrooms or whatever is part of that. But if this is how decision-making is taking place, when you have advice from Treasury, which tells you what? That the school is not even fully registered, right?
Yep.
And that even if it was fully registered, it wouldn't be on the top of its list for projects to choose.
But you've got the Crown infrastructure people saying it is near the top of their list and they like it. So you've got some official endorsement of it.
Yeah, you have. But again,
partly the hypocrisy, though, is that moral high ground part, right? That the Greens sort of have taken over the years and to question some of the spending, be it of National and throughout the sometimes New Zealand First and Labour. And I guess to the due diligence, supposedly, or at least this is what we've been told, was the minister having a look at a website and checking what it looked like. And if that is the level of due diligence by a minister, I think then that is a problem and a concern, but also because it wasn't that long ago in Parliament where James Shaw was making all sorts of comments about the decision-making of New Zealand First, of the previous national government. And that's, I think for me, that's where the hypocrisy comes in, aside from the fact that the Greens' policy is don't put money into private schools.
So is it a resignation issue?
No, in my view.
I think he'll be judged at the polls by his own people, won't he?
Yeah, he will be. I don't know how many votes the Greens will lose over this. It probably stops some people coming on board, and if you are sort of a soft Green voter, it may affect you. But the Greens largely is a well-off person's party. And they won't like that, but it's true. And if you look at the seats where they do very well, the Auckland Centrals, the Wellington Centrals,
urban
if you go
liberal
to the
seats.
South Auckland seats, they get very, very few votes.
Yep.
So it's quite comfortable people who are voting for the Greens. I don't think a lot of them are going to be put off by this.
There's a big split between what the Greens want to be and what they really are, right? And that they are. They are very much, there's a lot of middle class and a lot of women voters who come in behind them. That's their, that's the party who, the people who vote for them. And I can imagine some of those people would look at this and go, oh, this makes them, it reminds them of the mung beans, and it reminds them of, with all the crystal stuff being talked about, but also reminds them of them, are they serious? Are they fiscally disciplined? Are they responsible? It raises all the bad stereotypes for the Greens, and Shaw will be kicking himself for that, because the ever-suited James Shaw has been trying to downplay that image for years.
I don't know if people who are really serious about the environment and really serious about climate change, though, are going to ditch the Greens because $10 million was spent on a school that wasn't a great project. I agree. I'm not downplaying it. I think it's a serious issue. And, look, I'm the first journalist to get in there and say, hey, look, the due diligence wasn't done and hypocrisy. I get all that. I totally agree. I just don't think it's as catastrophic as some
of it. It's a civil war, isn't it? It's inside the Green Party. It is an opportunity, potentially, for some people who don't like what James Shaw stands for as one of the co-leaders and may be more interested in some of the social policy to, well, drive a wedge.
Totally agree with that, but they'll find that they won't get into Parliament on that.
No, they're kneecapping themselves.
They need the respectable sort of Green business face that James Shaw represents, because a lot of their voters, as I say, are wealthy. I've talked to bank executives who voted for the Green Party last time.
But they
do well in Epsom.
Yes.
Yeah, and I've had, you know, the opportunity to sit in a room with James Shaw, as he's been sort of leading conversations with a whole bunch of business types, and he can hold his own. He is absolutely someone who can sit in that room, who gets the understanding of the people in that room, who previously probably would have looked at a Green invitation and gone, well, I'm not going to that discussion, but he has the ability to do that, and he's done a lot of work in that area over the last 3 years. It was quite interesting, I found, when he was standing at the podium with Martin Davidson, and you could almost feel the tension between the two of them. You could see it, and then the questions that were being put to them around whether or not they thought it would have an issue at the polls, and both of them looked very, very shaky. And I think, you know, I totally accept Guyon's position around that sort of the money side of the Green Party that will vote for them anyway, because they see this as actually not being a bad thing. But there'll be that possible swing voter of the Green side who might be now looking at them going, well, I won't go out and vote on the cannabis reform and actually go and vote Green.
Yeah, and I would think that if anyone's a beneficiary of this, it would be Labour.
Yes.
I don't think those voters are going to run off anywhere else.
No, I tend to agree with you on this, Guy, and I think the vote with the Greens, the base is, there is that base of traditional Green voters, and this tension between the corporate Greens, if you like, and the more liberal Greens is as old as the party, right?
Well, to be fair to them, a coalition of those groups. I mean, that's okay.
Yes,
you can be a coalition of different ideas.
But
all parties are to some degree. And there is a coalition between Green business type folks and social justice warriors. And we can dress that up as a big tension, and there will be tensions.
Yeah. It's in every party.
But it's also a coalition of interests,
it is,
isn't it?
There is a real anger. I think, you know, talking to some of the Greens people that I've spoken to who are not in the Shaw camp, I think there is a genuine anger there, because there has been, I think, a resentment about them for a long time. They don't like some of the things that you're praising, Scott, are exactly the things that they don't want for
and
their party.
It's
not
so,
the party they want to be.
And they
want
to be so pure that they're out of Parliament.
Exactly. Well, they will say, you know, this guy has, the big thing I think will be that this guy has for 3 years said, I can only get so much done, I'm powerless, Winston Peter's a bully and a chaos merchant, I can't get stuff through cabinet, I can't get what we want. And he has not put his foot down. He has not put his foot down over water bottling or carbon stuff or a lot of the stuff that they wanted him to put his foot down over. And he's put his foot down over a private school. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of anger, I think, within the party about that.
But when you look at it, these guys are in struggle street anyway, if we look at the polls, right? So they're hovering around 5% and have been for the year. But if we look further back than that, and I love a good poll result, and if you look back here, I've got the Reed Research poll back to 2014, and it's the trend you look for, as we say, in these polls, and it's only going one way and quite rapidly. So when you think that they were polling in 2014, 14%, 14.4%. 11%, you know, and this year, the various polls, best case scenario, I think, puts them at 6% in one poll and down to 4.7 in one of the others. So they're in that danger zone.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
And Bryce Edwards wrote an interesting piece, which he reminded us all that the Greens are the ones that tend to go down 1 to 2 points at the actual poll.
Yep. So people like that, yeah. But where are they going to go? I think Owen's point, somewhat will probably go to Labour, but it's a pretty conservative...
But they just don't get out of bed, though. Isn't that the problem?
Some will look at the Māori Party, but then they'd have to suck up John Tamahere.
They normally poll leading up to an election, but then get to election day, they're always softer on election day. And you know, it surprises me that an election campaign, which we're about to go into, obviously, where we are talking about a referendum on cannabis, that the Greens don't have a stronger following at the moment. Isn't it just logical that some side of that party will go out and gain a whole bunch of votes?
Well, because Jacinda Ardern has eaten the left. I think, you know, Ardern has become the mother of the left. And so,
the other thing to watch for, and this is more of a logistical thing, is the specials this time, because we don't have the Kiwi diaspora that we normally have, right?
No.
So normally you're on election night, you're waiting for the specials to come in because the Greens do very well on the specials. You usually get another seat. I don't think that's really going to be such a factor this time. A lot of those people will be home.
Yeah.
True.
I think what Shaw has to do now is just wait it out, right? I still think strategically, if Labour stays relatively strong, people on the centre left in 7 weeks' time are going to go.
He's got 6 or 7 weeks.
Yeah.
If this thing will eat itself,
If you want a Labour Greens government, if they want a Labour Greens government and they don't want New Zealand First, there's still a pretty straightforward path there for the left to figure out how they want to play this.
Yeah, but imagine those coalition discussions. You've got a guy who's been sitting, you know, in a ministerial car trying to battle for money coming out of the government coffers, and that party at the moment, his own party's gunning for him. So after the election, let's say they're sitting there and they're in a discussion with the Prime Minister-elect, what do they do? Do they go back and sit around that table? Do they want to put themselves under that pressure again? There's some big questions for them post-election.
Let's just remember that James Shaw was not the only party leader who was apologising this week. Judith Collins had to apologise for some social media advertising that happened. And this was around the post by the National Party talking about Chris Hipkins' answer to Shane Duretti in Parliament last week, which we talked about on the show last week, the people not getting tested after 3 days. But it was on a fake Labour Party letterhead, and Trevor Mallard, a speaker, said, take it down. And she said, yes, sorry. It is. So social media is an interesting one. We're going to talk about a few of the examples this week. But what do you make of this, guys? Social media is certainly playing a role already before the campaign really kicks in.
Yeah, I think with that National Party example, because we're going to talk about some other examples, so I think it's important to make the distinction. They got the slap across the wrist because of the fake letterhead that they superimposed the quotes onto. And also they abridged a parliamentary answer. They abridged it. They took out some of the content, so it wasn't the full answer. So that's why they got a whack for that. There's some interesting stuff on social media this week and the memes regarding Jacinda Ardern. I'm going to be interested to see what you guys say about those, because that was in relation to Judith Collins's husband, and a number of people were saying that they were sexist and misogynist in out of line. What say you guys?
I thought they were just stupid. I thought it was a stupid thing for him to do. Spouses can be off limits, but the public is going to judge you to some degree about what you do as a unit, right? They are going to say that. I mean, if Clark Gayford went out there and said something controversial, of course it would be news. So I just thought it was a stupid thing for him to do and very unhelpful. To his partner.
It's not what they want to be talking about.
No, and I thought she actually handled it fairly well.
Well, let's have a listen to how she did handle it.
Your husband's been sending out, you know, sulky Hulk memes. Do you share his views?
Do you know, we've been together for 41 years. I've never been able to get him to do anything I tell him to do. So I've just said to him, well, you know, it's not what I would do, but he's an adult. He makes his own decisions. Yeah. And I think he's just gets sick of people having a go at him and me. But there we are. Sure. It's his decision. Yeah. Let's put it this way. I don't have to answer for him because, you know, I haven't been able to control him in 41 years.
And I've got to play this next clip because it prompted a rather nice response from Grant Robertson when he was being questioned about the Green School in Parliament yesterday.
Mr Shaw's advocacy of the project is well and truly on the record. Perhaps I can put it this way for the member, that a coalition government's a little bit like a marriage. You can't always control what your partner does or says.
To the Minister of Finance. Well, perhaps he could then ask whether or not he can control his Associate Minister of Finance.
As I said to the member, a coalition government is a little bit like a marriage. I've known Minister Shaw for not quite 41 years and I respect him and I can't control everything he says or does.
I think that's where I agree with Guy, and it was just silly. And what I think Grant Robertson did well there was he turned it back on Judith Collins. And the trick with social media is the ability to be smart on it. And something like the using the Hulk one around the PM being angry, it probably led itself to other people outside of the circle making memes about it. It didn't need to be that close to Judith Collins. I think, you know, as an example, David Seymour this week, I'm not sure if you've seen it or not, but ACT used quite a smart tactic with social media where they had the yellow of ACT, but it almost looked like the COVID type of branding about making sure that you vote correctly on election day, a critical message. And it was one of those things that was just smart. Mm. And Grant Robertson, I think, did the same thing there.
Yeah.
There's enough questions at the moment that you don't have to be dirty politics.
Totally agree. I mean, we've been talking about the influence of social media, which is obvious, right? But we're just not using it very smartly in politics at the moment. I'm amazed. And here we are in 2020. I mean, even in 2017, Twitter and Facebook were a big deal, obviously. I'm surprised at the lack of sophistication that it's being used with it by our political parties.
A lack of sophistication and a lack of smartness is the same thing. Really simple, basic, visceral kind of stuff is actually pretty smart, isn't it? That's how memes work. It's a gut reaction thing.
Oh, yeah. But what did he use? The Cindy line and stuff. It's just pathetic.
Yeah, but people respond to that. Isn't it, you know, it's not clever, but isn't it effective?
I don't think so.
No.
For me, I thought some of the most dodgy parts of those memes were the references to Woo Flu and other things like that, which I think absolutely backfire. On the subject of controlling your spouse or yes, other half, I actually think, why ask that? It's not the response. You know, if someone asked my partner to get me under control, I would find that highly offensive.
Yes.
And the reverse. So why say to her?
Well, it's sort of look, and it's not relevant. I went on the project this week to help pimp out this fine podcast that we make. They used me as a commentator and I said, you get two votes in New Zealand, one for the party, one for the electorate. You don't get a vote for the spouse or partner. That's what they think is irrelevant. That the spouse or partner isn't making laws or sitting in select committees or anything. So he can say what he likes.
I agree with that, but the public is going to see it and have a view on
Agreed.
It. And if you're on Facebook, you are in public.
Yes.
And would he have gone to a public meeting and said that? Would he have gone on the radio and said that? Would he have put up a billboard and said that? Because it's the same deal. And I agree with you In theory,
yeah,
totally.
Reality, you know, though.
But in reality, yeah, it's just a dumb thing to
and
do.
And from a brand point of view, right, you've got a Labor government that's branded itself on the kindness party. So all you're doing is underscoring that you're not very kind on the other side, which doesn't help National.
So I agree with both of you in the sense that you say you don't get a vote for the partner, and I agree with Guy on it, you know, the proverbial sticks, and whatever your other half is doing is going to be associated with you, whether you like it or not. And the other thing that I find highly interesting is that this is a guy who stayed quiet for years and years and years, and then
he's just had enough.
Well, one wonders, because
like James Shaw, when
all of that was raining down on Judith Collins during, you know, the John Key government over Ora Vida, and she was continuously being taken to task.
Well, he was in the company, of course,
and he was in the company.
He was the conflict of interest.
As I remember it, it was communication silence from that department. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere,
she's leader now, though. It's her party.
But the response, there is a responsibility that comes with social media, right? And the fact is, at the moment, given that MPs and candidates haven't been able to get onto the campaign trail, everything is on social media, and people are just captured there, right? And there is a responsibility that comes with that. And some of the stuff, not from people or parties who are in Parliament at the moment, but other parties or wannabe parties, are seriously concerning some of the things that have been said out there in social media. And you just hope that a click or an engagement or a like doesn't necessarily transpire to be a vote at the polls, because you wouldn't want to see some of these people get anywhere near the Parliament building.
The kind of thing you're talking about, Scott, is the other main complaint this week, which has gone to the Privileges Committee, and the Privileges Committee have unanimously found this to be in breach. It's a posting on social media by the Advance Party, the People's Party of New Zealand, which is the Jamie Lee Ross, Billy TK vehicle. And they put out a clip about a minute or two long. We're obviously not going to play any of it because it is false and wrong and inaccurate. But the guts of it is that it uses clips from Parliament saying of Megan Woods as minister, saying that, or implying that there would be a law passed, that there is a law being passed that would force mandatory vaccination of people, of New Zealand citizens, for COVID. It has been very clearly cut, though, because what she was actually talking about was the possibility that the law allowed for, which was that people coming in the future, people coming to New Zealand from overseas, might be required to have had a vaccine and to be vaccinated before they're allowed to enter the country. So two very different things. Compulsory vaccination of New Zealanders on one hand, and the requirement of a vaccination for visitors on the other, or people coming to
New Zealand. And let's be clear on that. The law as it is at the moment does not specifically state any vaccination for visitors. It leaves the door open to potentially introduce that at a later date. But there is no, this mash-up, if we can call it that, inferred a mass vaccination program across the board.
And it got shared more than 5,000 times on Facebook.
You know what? I reckon we need to get serious about this stuff and fine people big time for fake information like this. You know, we mess around
Privileges Committee.
We wring our hands and we send them off to the Privileges Committee or the Advertising Standards Authority. I think, you know, in an election period, if you can have a designated period where you're allowed to spend so much money and you can regulate that period, you could say, especially during an election campaign, actually put the onus right back on them and say, if you're going to be, if you've shown to have false and misleading information, you get fined big time. Thousands, tens of thousands of dollars, because that'll make people sit upright.
And even the concern is always that it will stifle political debate. Because where's the line between inaccurate information and spin?
This is a health claim, so there must be some. You know,
I mean, this is a pretty clear cut one. I agree.
In health advertising, there are very strict rules about what you can say. So you know, this is a public health issue, and it is beyond a debate about various other, elements of a political campaign.
How do you draw that line? How do you draft that law?
We're having to do it all the time. In fact, I think you sit on one of the media bodies that does that.
Yep,
and media has to do that all the time. And you've got to stand up your claim. And if people make honest mistakes or smaller mistakes, then okay, fine. If you're found to have been deliberately misleading and grossly misleading, well, maybe there should be a penalty for that, because...
Yep, well, Well, that's dangerous, right? That stuff's not just dumb, it's actually dangerous. And I think the difference between, let's say, some of the political attack ads that you see in America, and, you know, you go back to the Hillary Clinton ones that that came out, 4 years ago, those are, they're blatantly, you can see them, right? They're not just mashups that are meant to be seen as being real. They are just mashups and they're there as attack ads. Whereas I think the difference with this one is that you've got a wannabe party or a political party that's trying to push a dangerous agenda. And unfortunately, people who are living in uncertain times will latch on to these types of things. And that's, for me, is where the real danger is, that that a section of the public will look at it and believe it. And I just think that that's, I agree.
Well, they are.
And if you
look at the
comments. If you got pinged, say, 30 or 40K for that out of the party coffers and had to pay up, you'd think pretty seriously about whether or not you were going
to
do that.
Well, even the potential to take stuff down. I mean, the fact is that Jamie Lee Ross just said, we're not, you know, we think this is a draconian and terrible ruling by the Speaker, and it's still there. It hasn't been taken down.
Yeah, and the thing is, this is not the only person, this is not the only statement that's being made that is dubious as well. You know, claims that Billy Takei is making about military being given the same powers as police officers, absolute.
Tosh.
Yep. And also, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
It's very old-fashioned.
And also other claims around 5G and other things. So we've got a lot of conspiracy theories circulating around this pair in particular. But look, let's call it now. I mean, time of death on their chances, you know.
About 3 weeks before they started.
It's pretty hard. What do you need? About 135,000 votes, I think, to get to 5%.
Well,
it's pretty, it's
not,
pretty tough.
They're not,
I mean,
going to make...
If the Greens and New Zealand First are struggling, then these guys are going to really...
They're not going to make the 5% mark, so they're relying on Jamie Lee to deliver botany to them, right? Yeah. So what was it? 13,000 vote majority for him last time when he was standing as...
He's up against Chris
the national,
Nixon.
Yep, the national candidate. And the party vote is even more of a romp in there, with 60% of the party vote going to National and only 30% going to Labour. So they're entirely reliant on Jamie Lee Ross. Goodbye before you even started.
Yeah. But I mean, the point is that I absolutely agree with that. I think it's interesting that they will, you know, and the willingness of them to publish this kind of stuff. And Jamie Lee Ross is clearly trying to leverage this into a story which he can get publicity out of to try and find those votes. He's desperate. But these... It was New Zealand On Air research this week came out, and YouTube is now the most popular channel in New Zealand, ahead of TV1, ahead of TV2, ahead of TV3. Facebook is just behind TV1, ahead of TV2 and 3. These are the most popular and most watched things. Now, people aren't going there for news per se, but we all know how things appear on your timeline.
Yeah,
and
well,
this,
back to,
and
back
the
to
side,
my point,
you know?
We've got to get serious about regulation for it. I mean,
you have a
BSA regulating your TV and your radio. You can't just go on say whatever you like.
No.
If these channels are going to get those sorts of viewerships, and that's for the Facebooks, the YouTubes and Twitter, you should be regulating them seriously.
But it goes back to your point, Scotty, as to whether views online translate to actual support at the polling booth.
Yeah, and I'm one of those ones who hopes that it definitely doesn't. I think that it's dangerous, the type of stuff that they're talking about, and unfortunately there will, there are people who are looking for information, and it ain't, and to Tim's point around YouTube being the place where most people go to get their viewing platform now, and that's the danger for me. And if you've got the ability to go and use a platform. There needs to be responsibility and accountability around it.
Well, can I use that as the perfect segue into how you use a platform responsibly if you're indeed the Prime Minister or the Minister of Health? Because the Podium of Truth has been talked about this week a little bit, and it stems from the crisis, the confusion over the weekend about whether West and South Aucklanders should get tested, whether they're asymptomatic or symptomatic. Regardless. But it stems back to this quote that Jacinda Ardern gave back in March, and she said this.
I cannot go around and individually dismiss every single rumour I see on social media, as tempted as I might be. So instead I want to send a clear message to the New Zealand public. We will share with you the most up-to-date information daily. You can trust us as a source of that information. You can also trust the Director General of Health and the Ministry of Health. Otherwise, dismiss anything else. We will continue to be your single source of truth.
Single source of truth.
Yeah, and Ministry of Health too, exactly. Which is where the information was up. I thought this was bad, and I thought it was damaging, and I thought it was one of the bigger missteps. And I'd put this right up to the top to the PM, actually. To have that out was damaging. You could have had people who had COVID, who were symptomatic, who'd gone, looked at that queue, and gone, no, bugger this, I'm going home, and didn't get tested. They waited far too long before they pulled it down, and then I think weren't gracious and fulsome enough. Should have borrowed from James Shaw and his apology in their acceptance of what they'd done wrong. And so I thought this was a bad misstep, and I'd push this right up to the ninth floor.
But the decision itself, the wording itself, came from officials.
Yeah, so sure. But she knew well before the 1 o'clock press conference, or might have been about 1:20 or something, by the time she actually used the Q&A session with reporters to tell people it was wrong. I just think that they waited far too long to do that.
Well, the Tulish response is an interesting one. Alex, can we play the second clip from Judith Collins?
Was her government the single source of truth when it mistakenly told 700,000 Aucklanders to get a COVID-19 test and then failed to proactively correct the record?
Mr Speaker, I refute the last part of the member's question. We did seek to proactively correct that information when it was identified. And Mr Speaker, as I Order. Said in the House yesterday, as I said in publicly on Sunday, a mistake was made that has been corrected. And again, I apologise to any New Zealander who had any anxiety as a result of that incorrect information.
Yeah, and when I look at that and I listen to that, it's the fact that she sounds so defensive over the problem. Own it. You know, as somebody, you can't take the good without taking the bad. And when you're sitting in that position and saying, trust us, we are the single source of truth, and something doesn't go right, and let's be fair to the officials and to the government response on this, they've got most of that type of communication right. This has been one of the ones, the outliers, and it was a big one. But then just own it. And I think that's, for me, the problem is when the PM sits there and goes, I completely refute that.
Yeah, she doesn't refute. I hate the fact that they get that word wrong.
She hasn't proven
She's rejecting it.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
You're right. I totally agree with Scott there. And you see Joseph Stiglitz, a famous economist, commenting, I think, for the IMF about singling out New Zealand's response as world class. I agree. They have got most of the communications bang on. But when you don't, you should own it.
Yeah, but we're reaching critical mass here, aren't we? Because we're here talking because there's an election looming.
Aye.
And that's the issue here. She's driving along in the car thinking to herself, I don't want a wheel to fall off before I get to the polling booth, right? And then, whoop, the wing mirror's been clipped up by someone as she's zooming along. And she's like probably thinking, God, can I get a break here? I've only got to last a few more weeks and hold it all together.
Well, we've had something to talk about every week on this podcast. So, you know, you
exactly.
And you go back to the woman leaving quarantine and, you know, going up the motorway the wrong way, the testing of border staff not getting done, the day three testing not getting done.
Strangely enough, without COVID-19, they might have been in a much weaker position as a political entity. Because you look just today, woeful progress on child poverty, another area where they made huge promises and haven't delivered on. So, you know, in some ways, imagine what we'd be talking about in this campaign if it weren't for COVID.
Yeah, and therein lies why she was so strong on wanting to go on September 17, right, and went all the way to the last day before making the call to push the election date out, because these last couple of weeks have been everything you'd assume that the PM didn't want to have happen. Some of these things are not in her control. Yes, they land at her desk, but they are the types of things that people will start questioning. And I think, you know, before the change of the election date, people were talking about Labor basically strolling to the win and strolling to some huge number, whereas now there are questions and you've got a change, I feel, in the environment, at least anyway in the community, where people are starting to question. They're starting to become less kind. People outside of Auckland don't want Aucklanders to come to conferences in other areas of the country.
Shall I change my flights, mate?
It's not the winter of discontent, but there is a change in the air.
The spring
of
unease.
The last thing you want.
the spread
of disease.
You don't
want that going into an election.
No, no. But I still think people will cut her and the government a fair bit of slack over that stuff. But you're right. It's
maybe,
you know,
not her deputy PM.
No, maybe not. Stuff like the child poverty stuff, though, is the kind of thing that they can take responsibility and should be taking responsibility for. She is the child poverty reduction minister.
And it won't be debated.
And
it won't
she's,
be debated
she's
in
promised
the campaign.
At the start of the term, they promised 70,000 kids out of poverty, and now on the back of this UNICEF report today, they're saying, look, we've got 18,500 out, aren't we great? So, you know, it's a long way from the promised results.
Exactly.
And that is on them.
And Guyon says it won't be debated. So maybe this is a future caucus podcast
where
we look through the lists of what they said. Well,
I think it should be. I'm
achieve.
Just saying that's, you know,
yeah.
I think it is a COVID election, isn't it?
There's
no doubt about that.
And so let's, before we wrap up, let's just talk about who's actually in this government and dealing with COVID. Because according to Winston Peters on the election trail, now, because he didn't even wait for Parliament to end to get back on the trail, he said yesterday, oh, government? What government? Not my government.
The fact of the matter is that the Labor ministers are the only ones in charge of that. We did foreign affairs, others did defence and everything else, but they were in charge of that. And there were mistakes made. And it's better to own up to them, because the sooner we own up to them, the more quickly we can fix them. Don't keep on gilding the lily and saying everything was fine. It wasn't fine. The testing wasn't going on, the surveillance wasn't going on. The oversight and scrutineering that should have been done by the military did not happen. And masks were not used. We haven't done as well as we could have done.
Well, that's absurd. I mean, is he not going to take any responsibility for the financial direction of the government because he didn't have that portfolio? I mean, have we heard of cabinet collective responsibility?
It's supposed
to be a single government that the cabinet decisions you sign up to, you're bound by them. Now,
and he has been at the cabinet table signing up to the COVID response.
And he's been the number two. And he talked about how we'd crushed COVID and we'd kicked it, and he used all these other great sound bites and how well we'd done. And now that he's on the campaign trail, he's somehow trying to contort himself into this idea that he's actually holding the government to the account.
But on one level, this is quite outrageous.
It's the fourth government he's been in, and he's in the government as the number two.
Yeah.
So to turn around and sort of try and say, oh, this government hasn't done very well, is absurd.
And it's not just tricksy politics. You're saying that actually from a collective, you know, cabinet collective responsibility, there are rules around this stuff, that he is actually bound to the cabinet decisions.
Yeah, there are. And famously, people have resigned in the past before doing that.
Before criticising cabinet.
Yeah.
Tatiana Tudia, all those years back, didn't agree with the seabed and foreshore and walked from the cabinet collective responsibility. One of the things that there's been these platitudes normally coming from Winston or some of his supporters about New Zealand First finally making it through a term in government and not getting to the end without falling out of favour. When does Parliament actually rise and when is writ day? And is there still an opportunity that platitude goes out
still
the window?
Quit the Parliament's out, but he could still quit the government, I guess.
Well, you know, all bets are off now, aren't they? And as Guyon points out, Winston has skipped out of school early and got onto his campaign bus to head off into the sunset to scrape every last vote up, which, if the polls are anything to go by, he's going to need, because the trend puts them well below where they need to be. So he is using to, you know, use an old quote, any means necessary to get what he needs to get over the line. Yeah. And if that's, you know, throwing crap on the others, he's doing it.
And it doesn't bode well for our incoming government, right? Which whoever is in power in the beehive for the next 3 years has got a hell of a job just to try and right the ship and get us back in again.
Well, the Greens don't want to work with New Zealand First. New Zealand First don't want to work with the Greens. We knew that much, but it's becoming pretty brutal now, isn't it?
It's called an election.
And we're going to get into that over the next few weeks, because, you know, it's actually campaign time now, everybody. Quite looking forward to this next little period.
Do we get a bus? Does our caucus get a bus?
You might get an apology, mate, by the end of the election campaign, Guyon.
All right, everybody. Thank you. Scott Campbell, Guyon Espiner, Lisa Ryan and me, Tim Watkin. That's the caucus podcast for this week. You can subscribe and get this podcast delivered to your devices for free at any of the usual apps, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or find your way from the RNZ website if you want to go looking. It's been great to have your company this week. We'll see you again next Thursday.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.